Hello, everyone. Welcome to the reading of the Ford Dodge Messenger for Monday, March 22nd. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Glad to have you listening, as always. Got some sunshine, I'm trying to say, in the Ford Dodge area, but that's not going to last for long because we're expecting rain. Depending on who you listen to, we're expecting rain by the noon hour or perhaps a little bit after. We'll take a look at a more detailed forecast as we close our time together, but until then, let's go ahead and take a look at the articles in today's Messenger. Speaking of rainstorms, Severe Weather Awareness Week starts today. Severe thunderstorms or violent tornadoes can strike anywhere at any time in Iowa, and when storms strike, people can lose their homes or their lives. That's why Dylan Hagen, Webster County Emergency Management Coordinator, is emphasizing preparedness and alertness when it comes to severe weather. Severe Weather Awareness Week begins today. To stay tuned into what's happening in the skies, Hagen recommends having multiple ways to receive weather alerts. Ensuring that folks have more than one way to receive notification about severe weather, Hagen said. Some of those would be your weather radios, Webster Alerts, which are free for the public to sign up through Alert Iowa, several apps on your phone, outdoor warning sirens, local news, and radio, and social media. Hagen said the outdoor warning sirens aren't necessarily meant to be heard inside. To practice weather safety, Webster County will activate the tornado sirens at 11 o'clock on Wednesday. We encourage all businesses and schools and offices to participate in the tornado drill on Wednesday. The sirens will be activated countywide for 3 minutes. The county uses WeatherWarn to monitor and activate sirens. Hagen said when a real warning is issued, the sirens are activated through that web-based program. As soon as the Weather Service issues that, the dispatcher no longer has to physically activate the sirens. However, we can manually activate them if needed, but that's instantaneous from the Weather Service. Oftentimes, it will go off before the phones even do. It's a very good system. Calendar, Dayton, and Harcourt are the only communities not on the new system. Their sirens are not compatible with the system, Hagen said. We are working with those communities to upgrade their sirens. That way, everyone in the county is on the same system. When the sirens do sound, it is for a specific area. About 2 years ago, when the county began using WeatherWarn, it started activating sirens for only the tornado-warned area and not the entire county. If Harcourt is in a tornado warning, the sirens in Clare do not go off, said Hagen. Hagen said the county is considering sounding the sirens for more than just tornadoes. We only activate sirens for tornado warnings, but counties are looking at changing their activation policies for wind, like derecho, Hagen said. That's been a conversation to activate the siren for wind. Iowa was hit hard in August 2020 by a derecho. The storm left widespread damage comparable to damage that can be left by tornadoes. In addition to following alerts and hearing storms, Hagen said having a safety kit is important. Having a safety kit, first aid kit, blankets, water, flashlights, batteries, he said, have a plan and know where to go when the severe weather happens. At home, at work, out shopping or out to eat, it can happen anytime, anywhere, so you always have to be prepared. Typically, Webster County will offer a storm spotter class during the year. Hagen said one won't be offered locally this year. Instead, the Weather Service is hosting online courses. The next class is Wednesday at 1 o'clock. An advanced class will be held April 19th at 7 o'clock. Each day this week, the Webster County Emergency Management Facebook page will post about a different topic. Today, Hagen will post about severe thunderstorms. Knowing the difference between a watch and a warning, knowing the different types of thunderstorms, or what classifies as a severe thunderstorm, Hagen said a watch is more widespread. Just be aware that there is a potential for the threat of severe weather to occur, Hagen said. A warning, on the other hand, is a more defined location and a confirmed severe thunderstorm that meets the criteria. Hail 1 inch or greater, winds in excess of 57 miles per hour, or a tornado qualifies as a severe thunderstorm. Tuesday, Hagen will share information about warning reception. Wednesday, he will post about tornadoes. Thursday is preparedness, and Friday is about flooding. If the road is closed due to flooding, don't drive around the barricades, he said. You don't know if the water has washed away part of the road. When it comes to the weather, Hagen said, the most important thing is to stay aware. Just be weather aware, he said. Things can change very quickly. It's always important to have those alerts to your cell phone. Just be weather aware. We'll head back to the main page of the Messenger and find our next article. Fort Dodge Council is going to address RAGBRAI in a proposed budget. Child Care Center is also on tonight's agenda. RAGBRAI and some financial matters are on the agenda of the City Council tonight from Fort Dodge. The Council's work will begin at 5 o'clock with a workshop. That's when the elected officials will first discuss RAGBRAI, the annual bike ride across Iowa that will bring thousands of cyclists to Fort Dodge on July 26th for an overnight stay. City officials are working out an agreement with ride organizers that will spell out who is responsible for what when the cyclists are in town. The agreement also addresses costs and liability. A separate issue, downtown parking, not necessarily related to RAGBRAI, will also be addressed during the workshop. The council's business meeting begins at 6 p.m. During that meeting, the elected officials will consider approving the RAGBRAI agreement. They will also act on the proposed 2021-2022 budget, including all expenditures and transfers out. The budget totals $104,564,680. That's down from the current fiscal year's budget of $121-plus million. The property tax rate will be $20.42 per $1,000 of taxable value. The budget is for the fiscal year that will begin July 1st and end June 30th, 2022. However, state law requires cities to finalize their budgets in mid-March. In another financial move, the council is expected to act on an agreement with McNeil Incorporated, which owns Child Care Discovery Center. Under that agreement, the city will pay the business $600,000 over 11 years after it completes construction of a new facility near 14th Avenue North and 32nd Street. The money will come from tax increment financing, not the general fund, which pays for many government operations. The council is also expected to act on applying for a roughly $2.7 million low-interest state loan to finance construction of a new water main loop on the city's northwest side. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, Briggs Woods Park area is rich with history. The gift to Hamilton County came with a few special conditions. There are several amenities to enjoy while visiting Briggs Woods Park near Webster City in Hamilton County, camping, golfing, kayaking, and exploring trails. There's also an opportunity to take a step back in time and enjoy a piece of history. The barn shelter at Briggs Woods Park is the only remaining building from the Briggs family that settled in the area in 1862. According to history provided by Hamilton County Conservation, Ulysses Briggs, or Ulysses as he was called, came with his family at that time to a farm along the bank of the Boone River just south of Webster City. Ulysses became a stonemason and realized the great need for a lime to make cement. He had discovered good limestone along the river before he moved, so he built a kiln in which he heated the stone and crushed it to produce lime. The kiln was located on the south side of the Boone River, about a quarter mile downstream from where the Northwestern Railroad Bridge crosses the river today. He built a large frame house where the present barn shelter is located. Later, in 1919, Ulysses' eldest daughter, Thirza Briggs Aldrich, transferred 60 acres of the farmstead to the Hamilton County supervisors to establish the park. This gift contained three special provisions. One was that her brother Frank and his wife Grace could live in the farmhouse for the rest of their lives, and Frank could graze his cattle in the pasture. Frank was required to keep the fences in good condition. Another provision was Charles Briggs could harvest firewood from the park for his personal use during the remainder of his life, and the third condition was Aldrich requested the county never allow hunting in the park. Brian Lammers, executive director for Hamilton County Conservation, said he had been told the barn was once used as the county's conservation headquarters building for a time. They used to hold board meetings in the basement, he said. The basement was also used as a shop-type building for staff to work on and repair equipment. Later, the main level of the barn was converted to a rentable lodge facility. A concrete floor was put in at that time. In 2005, the barn received a new roof, new windows, doors, and paint in preparation for the 50th anniversary of the Hamilton County Conservation Board formation in 1956. The barn received more attention in 2019 in time for the 100th anniversary of Briggs Woods Park. Although it has been kept up through the years, Lammer said it is in dire need of attention. The foundation is getting weaker, he said. One day we hope to find the funding needed to renovate and preserve the barn, but time will tell. In the meantime, the barn shelter is a rentable lodge facility featuring electricity, water faucet, an outdoor charcoal grill, picnic tables, and a fire ring circle gathering area. The barn shelter, which overlooks the lake, is along 5.7 miles of paved hiking trail and is available April 1st through October 31st. We'll head to the main page of The Messenger. No one was injured in a fire near Colville on Sunday. That is the title of the next article. There's a picture of firefighters. A firefighter with the Duncombe Fire Department sprays a hose through a wood hole carved in an overhead door to fight a fire inside a garage at 2628 235th Street, about 3 miles east of Colville in rural Webster County. According to Otho Fire Chief Marty Smith, the fire, which was reported just before 5 o'clock, was likely started by one of the vehicles stored inside the garage. Heading back to the main page of The Messenger, we'll click on where it says more local news and we'll see if there's anything there waiting for us. A bipartisan measure intended to reduce borrowing costs for farmers and ranchers is being co-sponsored by U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra. The bill would eliminate taxes on income from farm real estate loans made by community banks. It is called the Enhancing Credit Opportunities in Rural America Act. The Enhancing Credit Opportunities in Rural America Act is an important proposal that will help provide lower-cost loans to farmers and ranchers, Feenstra, a Republican from Hull, said in a written statement. Our hardworking farmers feed and fuel the world, and I will support any effort that provides the resources they need to succeed in today's economy. The proposal would grant tax-exempt status to income earned on agricultural real estate loans administered by banks. Farm credit institutions already get tax-exempt status for agricultural real estate loans that they administer. Feenstra said the proposed change would create competition, drive down interest rates, and provide farmers with more affordable loan options. U.S. Representative Ron Kind, a Democrat from Wisconsin, is the bill's other sponsor. Feenstra represents Iowa's 4th Congressional District, which includes Webster County and all of its surrounding counties. Heading back to the main page of The Messenger, this article goes back a few days, but I don't recall reading it. A Fort Dodge man was arrested after an altercation at Old Boston's. A Fort Dodge man is in jail after police say he punched and broke a large window at downtown restaurant on Wednesday afternoon. According to the criminal complaint, Raymond Barton, 45, punched a large hole at Old Boston's restaurant and pub at 809 Central Avenue, causing it to break and causing over $1,500 in damage. Barton also hit two other individuals with a closed fist, causing an altercation. The incident was reported at about 4:45 p.m. Witnesses said they saw Barton consuming a large amount of alcohol while at the bar, and police said he was unable to speak or stand on his own when they arrived. Barton was arrested by Fort Dodge Police and was charged with second-degree criminal mischief, a Class D felony, public intoxication, a simple misdemeanor, and disorderly conduct, fighting, or violent behavior, a simple misdemeanor. Benton had his initial appearance in Webster County Magistrate Court Thursday morning, and as of late Thursday afternoon, he was still being held in the Webster County Jail on a $5,000 cash or surety bond. He also now has a no-contact order with Old Boston's. His preliminary hearing is scheduled for March 26. Heading back to the main page of The Messenger, Actually, we'll go ahead and head to the Messenger editorial page. And Daylight Savings Time is the title of the editorial. This comes from the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. Here we go again. The weekend of March 13th and 14th marked the biannual changing of the clocks ritual known as Daylight Savings Time. Why do we do this again? Sure, we've all had our minds in 2021 that getting Congress to abolish Daylight Savings Time or permanently stick with it. But once we get out of raging pandemic volatile economy mode, how about we move on to ending this weird clock-changing thing? New studies suggest that beyond being a change without much positive impact, messing with our sleep cycles is a downright bad idea. Daylight savings time is, after all, something of a myth. There really isn't any saving of daylight. We just moved the time of day a little bit so we might enjoy more time outdoors before sunset, which, if you like that, you would be vote for springing forward and then never falling back in the first Sunday of November. It would be one thing if there was an economic or energy savings in daylight savings time, but there is none. In 2005, before daylight savings time was extended by 3 weeks to save more of whatever we were supposed to be saving, the Department of Energy released a detailed report. Department of Energy officials noted that while people use less energy, meaning household lights, when there's evening daylight, exactly the same amount of daylight was pulled from the morning, requiring more household lighting then. Imagine that. Even worse, daylight savings time isn't a zero-sum game. The impact can be seen in all sorts of circumstances, and the effects are always detrimental, largely related to the disruption in the sleep cycle. The concerns raised are so great, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine last month called for ending the practice of moving clocks forward and back once we get past the treachery of COVID-19 and its ripple effects. Let's shut down this ineffective ritual and stop changing the clocks. And again, that is an editorial that appears in the Messenger from the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. Goodbye, Fort Dodge. It's been quite a journey. It's a column provided by Elijah Decius. He's a Messenger staff writer, and that he is leaving town. Watch your step in Fort Dodge, a net Fort Dodge native said to me in Storm Lake as I prepared to leave the Pilot Tribune for my new job at the Messenger in July 2019. It was one of several comments I received alluding to the town's infamous nickname around the state, and I'm glad I didn't listen to them. As the crime and courts reporter, it's true that I've covered over a dozen homicides in the region in less than 2 years, but any reporter doing their job well knows that the crime rate of a town isn't what defines it. In my time here, I've laughed and cried with the community as they granted me the trust and confidence that's required to bear your soul to a reporter in both good times and bad. You told me about the times you watched a loved one take their last breath and the times you didn't know what else to do. You showed me the triumph of the human spirit and the intimate meaning of events beyond the who, what, when, where, and why. And throughout all, the Messenger gave me the opportunity to show Fort Dodge the value of community journalism. As news over the last year seemed to change by the minute, I couldn't be more proud of what I was able to contribute to the community. Stories that provided a coherence punctuated by empathy that cuts through the noise. Today is the last day you will see my byline in the Messenger. On March 31st, I will start as features reporter for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, where I will specialize in human interest stories, personality features, dining and home and garden pieces. It's the people of Fort Dodge that helped me discover why I'm passionate about journalism, something more valuable than any of the prestigious awards I've won since I stepped into this job. As I step away, I couldn't be more grateful. Sincerely, Elijah Decius. Decius. I don't know how he pronounces his last name. Let's see here. The value of preschool can be summed up in one statistic found in the Fort Dodge Community School District assessments from the current academic year. Those assessments revealed that kindergartners who do not attend preschool performed on average about 18% lower than the classmates who did attend preschool. Here's another stark figure. It is estimated that 30% to 50% of minority youth do not go to preschool, It is alarming that so much learning is lost at such a young age. It is clear that missing preschool could have lifelong implications. The solution seems obvious. Get the little ones into preschool. Fort Dodge just might have another preschool option on the horizon. Athletics for Education and Success is now exploring the possibility of setting up such an educational program. APHIS has the space for a potential preschool at the former Hillcrest Elementary School that it purchased in 2010. A licensed daycare is already operated by APHIS there. Right now, Charles Clayton, the executive director of APHIS, is hoping to find out if there is a community support for our new preschool. We believe families in Fort Dodge would benefit from having another preschool option. There's nothing wrong with the preschool program operated by the school district or any of the local Clayton and his team at APHIS would develop a first-class preschool. We hope they move forward with this concept. And this is a Messenger editorial that appeared in March 19th's newspaper. Let's turn over to the Webster City Daily Freeman Journal. Their first article is entitled Detours Ahead. As the 2021 Second Street Project will begin on Monday, motorists who routinely travel the western part of Second Street in Webster City may soon find an alternate route as the 2021 Second Street Project gets underway Monday. Signs announcing the project start and detour signs started popping up Thursday in preparation for the construction work. The project will involve 2nd Street just east of Beach to Overpass Drive. Rash Construction of Fort Dodge was awarded the contract with a low base bid of $3.3 million. The company turned in alternate bids for additional work on Fair Avenue from 2nd to 3rd Street, Woolsey Avenue from 2nd Street North about 75 feet, Beach Street from 2nd Street North to 140 feet, Broadway Street from 2nd Street North to 3rd Street, and from 3rd Street to the railroad tracks for a total alternate bid of just over $1 billion. That would bring Rash's total bid to $4.3 million. Ken Wetzler, Webster City Public Works Director, said much of the work being done in the project is similar to what was done last summer with Phase 1 of the 2nd Street project. There will be new water mains, new storm sewers, new gas main, and new street lights, he said. There will be several detour options, according to Wetzler, and signs will be placed around the area to direct motorists. The trucks will be routed so that they take James Street and come up on Prospect, then meet up with the truck route through town. First phase of the project will extend from Prospect Street to Beach Street. Was completed in November 2020. Wetzler said the project is expected to be finished by the end of October, though good weather could mean an earlier completion, just as inclement weather could cause some delays. Parks and Rec Commission is going to hear about projects. Bids for work on two Webster City Park shelters will be let next week, according to city officials. Larry Floss, Director of Rec and Park Public Grounds, told the Parks and Recreation Commission that the West Twin Park project includes cement work and plumbing. The bids will be open Thursday, March 25th to improve drainage. The building of the structure itself will be done by volunteers, he told the commission. Once the cement is completed and the plumbing parts are done, then we can start on the shelter itself, depending upon the weather. Bids will also be open for the Burrow Creek Shelter Project on March 25th. That project will involve repairing the shelter supports and those supporting the roof, as well as concrete around the perimeter of the building to improve drainage. Brianne Lesher, Assistant of Recreation and Public Grounds Director, said the requests for bids were sent to several local contractors. Floss said work on the new playground equipment and fitness equipment at East Twin Park will continue with the addition of compressed rock around the pieces with a poured rubber pad to be added before the spaces will be open for use. The commission also reviewed a potential future plan for a new swimming pool complex, voted to support the future plan, the former hospital property. Floss said the outdoor pool is nearly 30 years old and suggested that while there is no plan or funds in place for replacing the pool, it may be time to start thinking about the future replacement. Engineer Wayne Schlottfeldt shared a drawing of what a pool complex on the site could look like. including parking areas, a space that could double as a warming house for sledders in the winter. The commission voted to support the future potential use for the property and agreed to pass the idea along to the city council. Flaws also said that Fuller Hall is sponsoring the youth track and field program for students grades 2nd through 6th. This is the first event we've held in over a year, Flaws said. Participants will have to wear masks unless running. He said the schools are letting the program use the track when it's not in use. The season will culminate in a city track meet. We'll take a look next at some lifestyle articles from the Webster City Daily Freeman Journal. Handballs are on the menu. If you're hungry for those, you want to go to the Alden United Methodist Church at 1512 Hardin in Alden. It'll feature a menu of handballs, cheesy potatoes, green beans, roll, and cookies on Sunday, April 11th. Serving is from 11 o'clock to 1 o'clock or until the food is gone. A free will donation is being accepted. Food Bank of Iowa Mobile Food Pantry is coming to Jewell Thursday, March 25th. The drive-thru event will be held from 4 to 6:30 at Bethesda Lutheran Church, 439 Main Street in Jewell. Food distribution will be drive-through similar to the past. Pull up to the main door and stay in your cars. Volunteers will bring the food to the vehicles. Small Group, the movie, to be shown at TLC in Ellsworth, Trinity Lutheran Church. Christian film Small Group, the movie, will be showing at Trinity Lutheran Church at 1629 DeWitt Street in Ellsworth on Sunday evening, April 11th at 6 o'clock. You may contact the church office at 515-836-4792 for more information. The craft show will support the American Legion. March Madness did not stop shoppers from hopping on over to Marshalltown's American Legion post. Local crafters and vendors selling anything from home decor to coffee cakes to support the American Legion and VFW auxiliaries filled the Legion's lounge on Saturday. 8 televisions tuned to the NCAA basketball tournaments also enticed shoppers visiting the lounge. The popular Dave's coffee cakes were on sale just in time for Easter. A raffle is held for a life chest complete with commemorative medals of all of Marshalltown's combined honor guard. A life chest is meant to offer a personal keepsake for a veteran's personal belongings and memories from their service. Home decor, candles, quilts, paintings, jewelry, wood, crafts, and even free kitchen supplies were all available at the event. Today has been a really good day. We've had a lot of foot traffic. I've gotten a lot of interest in my work, said local artist Carmen Downs, who was selling some of her work at the Craft and Vendors Show. She likes exploring possibilities with a variety of mediums through acrylic and watercolor paints. Some of Downs' paintings included watercolor sets of minimalist roses or larger acrylic paintings of detailed outdoor scenes. I kind of just play around to have fun, she said. Downs started painting steadily since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic after her employment's hours were reduced to 4 hours per week. I had to do something with my time, so I pulled out my art set and just started playing around, and this is what came out, she said. You are listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind, and now we'll take a look at today's obituary page. David N. Kaiser. David N. Kaiser, 61, of Fort Dodge, died Saturday, March 20th, with his family by his side at Trinity Regional Medical Center. The celebration of Dave's life will be held Tuesday, March 23rd at 7 o'clock in the chapel of Lapisweiler Funeral Home. Visitation is from 3 to 7 o'clock at the funeral home. People are invited to wear their favorite Hawkeye apparel. Survivors include sons Tim and Kaiser, Seth Kaiser, Michael Kaiser, and David Kaiser, mother Helen Kaiser, siblings Karen Lindbergh, Kathy Otten, Carol Linder, brothers Joe Kaiser and Bob Kaiser, former wife and friend Kathy O'Brien, numerous friends and all of his friends from the club, and his dog and buddy Molly. He was preceded in death by his father Norman Kaiser and the mother to Seth, Michael, and David. Christy Smith, and many other relatives and friends waiting for him in heaven. David Norman Kaiser was born May 8, 1959 in Fort Dodge. His pain is finally over, while ours has just begun. If you were lucky enough to know him, he was your friend forever. Be like Dave and pass that on. In the middle of his battered body was the biggest heart ever. Dave was always willing to help someone else, no matter what he was going through himself. His wishes were to have his body donated to the University of Iowa College of Medicine, where he will continue to help others. He was an avid Hawkeye fan. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. From Humboldt, Michael G. Bowen, 62 of Humboldt, died Friday, March 19th at his home. Services are pending at Loftusweiler Seaver's funeral home. Kamisha Gully, 43 of Des Moines, died Sunday, March 21st in Orlando, Florida. Services are pending at Loftusweiler Funeral Home. Cindy Diane Litwiler, 65, of Fort Dodge, died Saturday, March 20th at Abrazo West Campus Hospital in Goodyear, Arizona. Services are pending at Loftusweiler Seaver's Funeral Home. And that is the extent of today's obituary page. Let's go ahead and take a look at the sports section. Stuff of Legends is the title of this article. I listened to the interview, did a double take, stopped and played it back a few more times and tried to process what I had just heard. In fact, I still am. What did Spencer Lee just say? Moments after clinching a third consecutive national championship and further cementing his status as a modern-day NCAA wrestling demigod, Lee confessed, "The worst-kept secret of the weekend was out. Iowa's top-seeded 125-pounder had been dealing with an injury while competing in St. Louis. It didn't take a surgeon to see that Lee was far from 100%. I know that sounds strange, given he reeled off five consecutive victories in his bracket like it was nothing by a combined point differential of 59-8. He'd beaten Drew Hildebrandt, who had just rallied past Fort Dodge's Brody Teske in the semifinals, 11-0. He controlled Brandon Courtney of Arizona State in the finals, 7-0. Still, even to the untrained eye, something wasn't quite right. And that's when Lee let loose in what has become a viral 42-second post-match video filled with frustration, vindication, and a whole cluster of other emotions. Well, 8 days ago, I tore my ACL in my other knee. I'm wrestling with no ACLs, Lee deadpan, and you know, whatever, man, I didn't want to tell anyone but one, because forget excuses. Excuses are for wusses. And you know what? That was a tough tournament for me. I could barely wrestle. I could barely shoot. I can't sprawl. But you know what? I believed in my coaching staff and everyone that believed in me, and here I am. Let's delve into this ACL mission because my mind is still racing. I'm sorting this out as a journalist, fan, and a father getting older and hopefully a little wiser by the day. As a reporter, Lee has given me a wealth of information. The story writes itself. He's admitting that after a devastating diagnosis, ACL tears usually require major surgery and at least 6 months of recovery time. He basically responded by rubbing some dirt on it. This isn't normal. In fact, it's borderline inconceivable, especially given he also admitted in the same breath that his other ACL is also shot. As a fan, all this has me scrambling as well. I honestly believe Lee is arguably the best college athlete, pound for pound, in the country, regardless of the sport. And he is skyrocketing up the all-time charts in the NCAA history books. Only four wrestlers have ever won four national titles. Lee theoretically could be in line to join the list, but to do so with such a debilitating injury, or both knees, knowing that now, what exactly did we just witness? Historic. I reached out to a handful of coaches and experts and fans who know a lot more about it than I do. I was reminded that Tyrell Todd from Michigan tore his ACL midway through his senior year in 2009 and still captured gold some 3 months later. North Dakota State defender and teammate Grant Olson and Jeremy Gordon played a football season together on torn ACLs a few years ago, While obviously never advised, Lee actually wasn't doing something unprecedented, despite it sounding like an unthinkable juxtaposition at first blush. The dad in me, the boring, over-rational, and cautious side, is really struggling with the long-term implications of something like this. I get it. Lee is living in the moment, not worried about what will happen months or years from now. He wanted to finish what he started and clinch that third title. He was also motivated to help deliver the Hawkeyes their first NCAA team championship in 11 years, which he did. And Lee is obviously so much better than the competition at 125 from a tactical point of view that he felt like he could break down his opponents mentally and strategically despite not necessarily being able to dominate them physically. What does this mean beyond Saturday, though? The Olympic team trials are later this spring. The Summer Olympics are in Tokyo this summer. And then it's time to train for the 21-22 season, which would be classified as Lee's senior year. In other words, there's no time to slow down or go through the long, grueling recovery time ACL surgery recovers. Anything less than fixing the problem, however, would leave Lee vulnerable and a shell of his former self. I won 3. Awesome. Good for me. We won the team title. Awesome. That's what we came here to do, Lee said on Saturday night. This is what I wanted. This is what I've been training for my whole life. Now worry about what's next. For a guy at the top of the mountain, those decisions are about to come in fast and furious, and it's all the more reason to be frustrated that Lee, like fellow Hawkeye old-timer Luke Garza, national champion David Carr of Iowa State, and so many others, can't parlay this momentum and benefit from his own likeness while in Iowa City. Any financial reward for being an elite wrestler must wait until secures, and endorsement deals are after his time as a Hawkeye, which seems like a tenuous concept at best moving forward. I have no idea how this is all going to play out. None of us do. Lee has already gone through shoulder and knee surgeries in the past. Quite literally, he's giving the sport everything he has. We should both appreciate and revel in the moment, because those short-term sacrifices could ultimately make Lee more of a supernova than a superstar down the road. Let's hope everything works in Lee's favor and his talents will be on display for some years to come. This should be the beginning of something very special rather than famous last words. And that is a messenger column written by Eric Pratt. The Iowa Central baseball team gave head coach Eric Stein a little bit of everything here over the weekend. The Tritons, ranked 18th, scored 4-3 and 10-0 victories on Saturday, adding a 4-2 and 9-1 win on Sunday to complete a sweep over Marshalltown at Ed Barber Field to begin ICCAC play. It was good to see us figure out a way to win when we weren't playing our best, Stein said. We're still so early in the year that we really haven't had time to see what everybody can do in certain situations, but we were able to overcome our mistakes and get some wins. Devin Hurdle provided the heroics in the first game of the series, playing Derek Kay with one out. Kay stole second and advanced to third on the air. Devin Shrew pitched 6 innings, striking out 8 with Matthew Wilkinson earning the win. Iowa Central controlled the second game as John Klein tossed 5 innings of 4-hit ball, striking out 8 with 2 walks. Max Holy drove in 2 runs and Ryan Wickman scored twice with a steal. Hurdle again came up clutch in the first game Sunday, beating out an infield single to score the winning run with the bases loaded. Easton Dermody struck out 8, and Wilkinson picked up the win in relief. Former Pocahontas area All-Stater Jace Davidson earned his first career home victory, handling the duties on the mound in the nightcap. He struck out 4 and allowed just 2 hits with a walk. It feels awesome getting a W at our own place, Davidson said. I just try to pitch as well as I can for my teammates every time I'm out there. Our goal is just to continue to get better every time out. Ben Gallagher drove in 2 runs, and Travis Rittenhouse was 2-for-3, with 2 RBIs and a run scored. The Tritons are scheduled to host NIAC on Wednesday. It's always great to play at home, Stein said. The atmosphere is incredible, and the guys really feed off of it. Heading back to the main page of the sports section, number 16 Triton softball team also swept Marshalltown. The 16th-ranked Iowa Central softball team opened up ICCAC play in Marshalltown this weekend with a four-game sweep over Marshalltown. The Tritons posted 11-3 and 14-2 victories in five innings on Saturday, following with a 10-2 and 12-7 wins on Sunday. Abby Filgis drove in five runs to begin the series, going 3-for-3 with a triple at the plate. Filgis and former Humboldt standout Carly Thompson each had two RBI hits during the six-run second inning for Iowa Central, who are 10-8 for the season. Former Fort Dodge Senior High All-Stater Logan Schnetzer had a homer in the second game, with Kalo Wookie and Madison Huseman earning wins in the circle. "For as long as we've gone between games, I was happy to see our bats get going right from the start," said head coach Bo Jevin. "I told the girls before the game that these are the ones we have to win because of how deep and how tough our conference is, so it was good to see them take care of business." On Sunday, Kinsey Rosenblum set the tone early, driving in three runs on three hits, with Rachel Newell also played in three runs. Newell and Filgis had a triple each in the first game, as the Tritons committed no errors behind Huseman's five-strikeout performance. Iowa Central finished things off with a wild 12-7 victory, as Schnetzer hit two homers, had a double, and drove in four. Allie Stewart and Thompson each had three hits. The Tritons are scheduled to visit Nyack on Wednesday. Sophomore Salute will be the title of the next article. The tears on Sunday from Iowa Central head coach Sarah Horn continued to flow as each sophomore player was honored inside Hodges Fieldhouse. And while a handful of the group plans to return in the fall before departing, that didn't keep the emotions from growing. On the court, the 4th-ranked Triton Shine sweeping Southeastern by scores of 25-5, 25-22, and 25-12. Devin Scott, Baylen Johnson, Haley Alharithy, Carly Eckert, Easton Swanson, Keely Anderson, Taylor Rick, Alicia Johnson, and Darlin Okanaka were among those introduced following the match. Over the past two seasons, Iowa Central, 16-3 on the season, has gone 49-9, including a 23-4 mark in the conference and a 24-2 record at home. And while COVID-19 protocols have limited the crowd sizes, bleachers were as full as they've been for this group. "They are just a great bunch of kids," Horn said. "They are all wonderful people, and they work so hard. There really isn't ever a day we go to practice, and they aren't excited to be here and ready to go. I've talked with coaches around the league, and in this different year, it's just so nice to have a bunch like this. They enjoy playing at home in front of family and friends. I'm just so happy we were able to honor them." Iowa Central opened the match in a convincing fashion, scoring 12 of the first 16 points, before closing it on a 10-0 run. They had six aces and four blocks in the set. "We talked about taking advantage of our serving, and I thought we did a great job there. Southeastern is a good team that has just been hit hard by injuries this year. We knew they were better than that first set, so it was also good to see us come together there in the second and third to put it away." The Blackhawks, 7-13 on the season, held the lead and had the match tied at 20-all before the Tritons rallied with five of the final 7 points. In the third, Iowa Central never trailed, with Scott, a St. Edmund graduate, recording the final point on a kill. "We go in hoping to get as many sophomores in as we can on this day. We knew that it wasn't going to be easy with Southeastern, but it was so great to see Devin finish it off like that." Anderson had 12 kills, while Caitlin Steffs added 9 and Angel Baylark 8. Alicia Johnson recorded 31 assists with 12 digs. Johnson had 10 digs, and both Alharithy and Baylark fired 5 blocks. The Tritons now have 13-3 set sweeps this season and finish the year with Southwestern on Tuesday. The Region 11 tournaments begin on Friday, with Iowa Central likely to be in action next Sunday. Taking a look at a story from the Marshalltown Times-Republican, "Piglets Finding Homes at Iowa Mini Pig Rescue" is the title of the article. Adopting a single pig from the Animal Rescue League, Emily Oliver never intended to end up with a barn full. "Pigs are great as groups, so we got her a friend," Oliver said. "Once people saw I had pigs on my Facebook page, I started getting messages, 'Oh, can you rehome this pig?' or 'We need to get rid of this pig. We didn't intend to become an actual rescue.' It just kind of spiraled from there, but in a good way for sure. Oliver funded Iowa Mini Pig Rescue in 2018 and has been located in the Marshalltown area since July. One of the main reasons the Iowa Mini Pig Rescue receives pigs is due to misconceptions. People think there is such a thing as a teacup pig or a micro pig. These are fake marketing terms. They are not real. Mini pigs are real. People think they're getting a pig that, as an adult, the size of a Yorkie. That's completely impossible. Mini pigs or any pig weigh less than 300 pounds. The average weight of a mini pig is 150 pounds, and the average lifespan is 15 to 20 years. Oliver said some breeders perpetuate the myth of teacup pigs or micro pigs by breeding very young pigs together and then show pictures of the parents to potential adopters to make it seem like the newborn pig will only grow to the size of its parents. People see a piglet for sale and it's super cute, and they go for it and they don't realize what they're getting, Oliver said. Underage piglets are notoriously hard to raise. If separated from their mother, bottle-fed piglets can aspirate milk, leading to pneumonia, and need special heating and supplement requirements to stay healthy. On Saturday, Oliver will attempt to intercept three separated 11-day-old pigs from an exotic animal auction in Fremont, Nebraska. She fundraised money to purchase the piglets at auction through Iowa Mini Pig Rescue's Facebook page. Auctioning off piglets who are so vulnerable to anybody who has cash is basically a death sentence for them. We typically do not purchase pigs. It just continues the cycle of breeding. But in this case, the piglets would die regardless, and they would be sold regardless. Iowa Mini Pig Rescue has taken in pigs with behavioral problems, pigs surrendered by owners, abandoned pigs, and more. All pigs taken in are spayed or neutered and microchipped. Oliver said many people interested in adopting a pig are not aware of the challenges of raising a mini pig, and said she has to turn down most people looking to adopt. This is not to say pigs are bad pets. They are excellent pets. You have to give them your full effort, she said. Pigs are an interesting pet because they are smarter than dogs, but they are also very similar to toddlers in that they get destructed if they are bored. So finding a family that can handle them and is zoned for them is a challenge. The city of Marshalltown currently classifies all pigs as livestock and does not allow them to be kept as pets. However, Iowa Mini Pig Rescue is located just outside Marshalltown in an agricultural zone. Iowa Mini Pig Pet Rescue is fundraising money for the care of three piglets who were taken in after the original owner allowed the piglet's mother to give birth in the extreme cold of February. The piglets were kept outside, all but four died. Donation links, adoption applications, and additional information about Iowa Mini Pig Rescue can be found on their Facebook group by searching Iowa Mini Pig Rescue on Facebook. An Employer Innovation Fund grant will give the Marshall County Communications Commission the opportunity to put 20 Iowans through training. 911 Communications Director Rhonda Broaddus said she was very excited to learn her agency was a recipient of the $100,000 grant. Through that money, a series of 8 virtual one-week online courses will be offered. Applicants from all geographic regions of the state can be accepted. Funds will provide wraparound support such as internet reimbursement, child care costs, and other items needed to assist participants in completion of training. This will provide 20 Iowans with certifications upon completion of the 40-hour basic course as required by all 911 agencies in the state of Iowa. This is something really powerful for this agency and county to do, Broaddus said. Through the process, she hopes to get some potential employees in line for some future openings. I will put people on an eligibility list if I have an opening and hire from that list, she said. But Marshall County would not be the only place people could apply after they finish. Completion of the course will make participants eligible to work at any communication center in the state. Broaddus will be able to start signing people up for the course shortly. She said interested people may contact her at the Marshall County Communications Commission at 641-754-4750. By completing the course, Broaddus hopes people will get a better understanding of what a 911 center job is like and will be able to make a more informed decision as to whether or not they would be happy in such a position. People not realizing exactly what they would encounter is something the agency has struggled with in the past. This is not an easy job, she said. You take calls from people who are having the worst days of their lives, and you need to be able to handle it. You need to go into crisis mode. Objectively handling those calls takes a toll. Sometimes they are very difficult, and we are open 24 hours a day. You will not have every weekend or holiday off. You will miss your kids' soccer games and dance recitals. To help with the work-life balance impact, she said, being employed at the Marshall County Communications Commission comes with good pay and benefits, but even greater is the feeling of helping someone. No matter what, every day you help someone, she said, whether they are asking what temperature to bake a turkey at or helping their loved one who is having a heart attack or been in an accident. Yes, the center has gotten calls that were not life-saving. Broaddus said those are illegal, but 911 communicators first explain why those types of calls are illegal. If that person calls again and there is maliciousness, then charges will be filed. I have an amazing staff who take time and do all that people who call. I am looking for people who might be interested in doing this. Maybe they have not done it before. Maybe they had young children at home. But I am looking for people who can be trusted and want to see what we're about. Let's take a quick look at this date in history. Some highlights on this date in 1765. The Stamp Act was imposed on American colonies. In 1820, an American naval hero was killed in a duel. U.S. Navy officer Stephen Decatur, a hero of the Barbary Wars, is mortally wounded in a duel with disgraced Navy Commodore James Barron at Bladensburg, Maryland. That occurred on this date. Also on this date, in 2007, News Corp and NBC announced a new internet venture. In 1947, President Truman ordered loyalty checks of federal employees. In 1984, teachers were indicted at the Martin Preschool. Seven teachers at the McMartin Preschool in Manhattan Beach, California, were indicted after hearing testimony from 18 children. Included among the charged are Paigley McMartin Bucky, the head of the school, and her son, Ray Bucky. 7 years and millions of dollars later, the case against the teachers came to a close with no reputable evidence of wrongdoing and with no convictions. In 1983, we had the origins of the Hummer. 1945, the Arab League was formed. In 2014, a mudslide in Washington State killed more than 40 people. In 1894, first Stanley Cup championship was played. In 1933, the FDR legalized the sale of beer and wine. And in 1972, the Equal Rights Amendment was passed by Congress. And that's just a glimpse, a snapshot, if you will, of some of the items that happened on this date, March 22nd. Taking a look at the weather forecast, we're supposed to be getting rain before too long in the Fort Dodge area. On Tuesday, we'll have a high of 56 with a 100% chance of rain and thunderstorms, 90% chance of rain and a low of 42 degrees on Tuesday night. Wednesday, high of 51 with a chance of rain, 33 Wednesday night. Thursday, mostly cloudy, high of 52, 31 Thursday night. Friday, partly cloudy, high of 55, low of 37. Saturday, a high of 58, a low of 35. And on Sunday, high of 55 degrees on Sunday. And there's a scattering chances of rain during the latter part of the week, but kind of smaller chances, and mostly at night from the looks of things. But we're anticipating rain over the next couple of days here in the Fort Dodge area, and indeed throughout most parts of the state. So, anyhow, if you have plans, you might want to take that into account. That's going to bring us to the end of the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for March 22nd. With a little help from the Webster City Daily Freeman Journal and the Marshalltown Times Republican. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Thanks so much for sharing this time with me. Of course, this podcast and many others are available to you at IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. And of course, we encourage you to enjoy those podcasts. Look forward to visiting to you again, or with you again, sometime real soon here on IRIS. Bye-bye for now.